Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
Okay, from The Guardian. A tiny fireball that crashed into Georgian home is a 4.56 billion year old meteorite. And specifically, we're talking about Georgia, the state in the United States.
Right.
It was a cherry tomato-sized space rock that pierced the roof and dented its floor in the Henry County community of McDonough. University of Georgia planetary geologist Scott Harris subsequently looked at the fragments and established that they came from a meteorite which formed about 4.56 billion years earlier. By contrast, experts estimate the Earth at around 4.54 billion years old. So that's 0.02 billion years older than Earth, if I'm doing the math right. According to Harris, the homeowner reported to him that he had continued finding space dust specks around his living room from the asteroid strike. They intend to submit their findings to the Meteorological Society's Nomenclature Committee, which oversees naming new meteorites, and they're proposing this one to be called the McDonough Meteorite, attached to its location. Now, this was the 27th meteorite in the history of the state. It was founded in 1788, so that's kind of where we're starting to keep records, but it was among six meteorites in that group whose fall was witnessed, which makes it even rarer. Now, this is something that used to be expected once every few decades, but not multiple times in a short period, as has been the case.
Uh-oh.
That may also be because we've got modern technology in addition to an attentive public. And in fact, this article includes cell phone footage of,
what?
You know, a spicy meatball coming from the sky, looking all glowy.
Yeah, because that was my thought, too, is like, good on the homeowner to say it was a meteorite, right? How many people would just be like, trash fell, rock fell.
Right, a bullet, whatever. It's Georgia.
Well, to be fair, the meteorite hurled to the ground at about 12:30 p.m., emitting a boom and rattling houses across Atlanta.
Oh, okay.
So it wasn't really like a subtle sneaking under the radar thing. It was enough to get images spreading everywhere online because it was visible not only from North Carolina, but also South Carolina,
wow.
Even though it hit in Georgia. So this is wild. The U.S. National Weather Service did not initially recognize what had happened because on the agency's radar, it looked like lightning. They have something called a global lightning mapper, and they were like, oh, we got a lightning strike. But the local emergency management director said officials began suspecting a meteorite when it became clear the fireball had punched through a home roof and cracked through the laminate flooring to the concrete. Now, the affected homeowner requested that the government withhold their identity because they have a small child. But as we all know, Kal-El will grow into a wonderful human.
Or we know who Patient X is, and that's bad, too.
We're in that timeline, y'all. Think good thoughts. All right, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from El País, titled, "A device can read people's thoughts in real time, but only if they imagine the password chitty chitty bang bang."
I mean, it's a start.
Yeah.
I hope all the Neuralink research just keeps, it's like the Rickroll, where it's like they're trying to get people's minds and it's just chitty chitty bang bang. Oh, so
yeah. And there's kind of like two interesting parts to this. The chitty chitty bang bang thing is important, but also kind of a little clickbaity. You'll see what I mean. So a team of scientists has managed to read in real time the thoughts of four people affected by severe paralysis. The researchers from Stanford University acknowledge their concern about mental privacy and the possibility of accidental leakage of internal thoughts. So, to protect each user's inner world, the authors designed the brain reader to activate only when imagining a complex password, one unlikely to occur in daily thought, chitty chitty bang bang.
So it really is a password. It's not like that's the only thing they can read from their brain.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just the sleeper cell activation phrase.
Yes, exactly. But yeah, it is kind of an interesting throw-in because otherwise the rest of it is just focusing on the general recognition of a large vocabulary. But the password thing seems like it could have important implications in other areas of research too. So Stanford neuroscientist Benjamin Abramovich told El País, this is the first time that complete sentences of inner speech have been decoded in real time from a large vocabulary of possible words. Abramovich and his colleagues say their device can detect 125,000 imagined words. The Stanford team implanted microelectrodes in the motor cortex of three people with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, and a woman with tetraplegia who had difficulty speaking following a stroke. An artificial intelligence program facilitated the interpretation of the brain signals. Abramovich argues, "Our results wouldn't have been possible with non-invasive technologies. It would be like trying to record two people's conversations inside a football stadium during a match. A microphone placed right next to them could isolate their voices perfectly. A microphone outside the stadium might be able to tell you when a goal is scored, but it's impossible to determine the content of a person's conversation."
That's not necessarily true. We have microphones that can pinpoint that, but I get the metaphor.
Right.
Yeah. You know, this guy, he's just a thought engineer, not an audio engineer, Brad, so cut him some slack.
Yeah, it's not rocket science. Come on.
The idea of a headband-like device that could read thoughts without surgical intervention is still far off. But Spanish neuroscientist Rafael Yuste visited the White House in late 2021, invited by the U.S. National Security Council to warn about the imminent arrival of a world in which people will connect directly to the internet via their brains, using headbands or caps capable of reading thoughts. In this hypothetical future, artificial intelligence could autocomplete imagination, much like current word processors do. Companies such as Apple, Meta, and Neuralink have patented or are developing wearable devices of this kind. The researcher recalls that 2 years ago, another scientific team managed to read 78 words per minute from the brain of Anne, a woman who had lost the ability to speak nearly two decades earlier due to a stroke. That group, led by Edward Chang at the University of California, San Francisco, achieved 75% accuracy using implanted electrodes, but Anne still had to attempt to speak physically. A normal conversation in English is about 150 words per minute. So Yuste asserts that it's urgent to protect neurological rights and legislate for the protection of neural data.
Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting idea, right? But also, the moment you throw the word data next to neural, it gets a little more horrifying, like instantly.
Oh, yeah.
It's the data and the regulation that made me laugh.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Good point. So it is worth saying that his advocacy led Chile in 2021 to become the first country to take steps to protect brain information in its constitution. Will we do the same thing in the U.S.? Bets on no.
No.
Yeah, but the foundation has also promoted similar legislation in the Brazilian state of Rio Grande do Sul and in Colorado, California, Montana, and Connecticut in the United States. So they are trying to help. So Yuste applauds the Stanford team for establishing the chitty chitty bang bang password to activate their mind reader. He says, including a phrase as an internal password that prevents decoding is novel and can protect mental privacy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man problem, though. Like, don't think of an elephant. Congratulations, I just made you think of an elephant. If I put the phrase in front of you and you instinctively read it, is that enough? Or do you actually have to willfully choose to think about saying it?
What about those of us that think in pictures?
Mm. Exactly.
Or those of us who cannot control our intrusive thoughts.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, now I'm going to be thinking chitty chitty bang bang all day.
That's
for
right.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's
it's gonna
the
come
shield.
Up, I'm like, oh, wait, what if I thought it just now? All
yeah. right. It's like so much more pleasurable to say than abracadabra.
True.
I guess you could have your, if you could set your own password, then they wouldn't know what, you know, magic phrase to show you. They'd have to trick you into thinking a word they don't know. So that, okay. All right. I'm down with it.
Yeah. It's like real passwords. And if you forget it,
you're in trouble.
Yeah.
They just open up your brain. No big.
Yeah.
Next link.
Next link.
Well, we were thinking about elephants, so this comes from Discover. Elephants ask humans for food using nonverbal gestures, a first in non-primates. So there's some iffiness there, but I'll explain.
Yeah.
So as we know, humans communicate with nonverbal cues all the time, Italians especially. But now scientists have recorded captive elephants intentionally adopting different gestures to reach a specific goal. In this case, obtaining fruit from humans. The researchers note a surprising level of complexity with elephants using 38 gesture types to communicate their goals and then change their tactics when the requests were ignored. My first thought was like, my dog does that, but then she doesn't change her tactics. She just continues to stare until it gets done.
Right. 38 is more gestures than my dog has as well, but there's definitely some nonverbal communication going on when they want something.
Right. So goal-directed intentionality refers to the ability to communicate your goals effectively. Previous studies have shown that wild apes can use more than 100 gesture types and adapt their communication accordingly. But few other species are known to exhibit this behavior, and when they do, like our dogs, it's extremely limited.
Mm.
But now it seems goal-directed intentionality might be more widespread, as we're figuring out with all this stuff that humans are not so special after all. So to find out, 17 semi-captive elephants were presented with two objects, a tray of apples and an empty tray. An experimenter either offered the elephant a tray of apples, so that's the goal being met, a single apple, the goal being partially met, or an empty tray, which means obviously the goal was not met. In total, they noted 313 gestures and 38 different gesture types. So I'm not sure the differentiation there, but 19 of which were specific to individual elephants and 19 that were observed in two or more elephants. The majority of the directed actions, 161 of them, were directed towards the experimenter, followed by 29 directed towards their own body and 12 towards the tray containing apples. The gestures were almost exclusively made when the experimenter was present and attentive. Elephants continued to gesture when their goal was only partially met, and they adopted different gestures when their goals were not met. Combined, the researchers say this offers evidence for goal-directed intentionality in a non-primate species. And maybe we'll, you know, find if non-captive ones do when they kind of spread this out and whether they're talking to you. That's going to be a little bit more challenging, right, to figure out what that means. But I am sure they are talking to each other.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we're basically a step away from implanting something and teaching them to think chitty, chitty, bang, bang. Because it's like nonverbal communication. We're going to find out they're fully thinking thoughts, and it's going to be like the Rick and Morty headpiece for the dog.
That's right. Next link.
Next link.
All right. This next article is from Ars Technica, and it's about a scandal involving everybody's favorite source of free information, Wikipedia. So before we get into the meat of it, there's something worth clarifying here that not everyone may be aware of, which is that Wikipedia is available in hundreds of different languages, but crucially, each version of Wikipedia is its own collection of documents. Like the French language Wikipedia is not just a translation of the English version. It is a completely separate entity that is edited by French speakers with potentially different facts, though hopefully not contradictory facts, backed up by different citations, the whole shebang. And so because of this, there's a whole field of meta research comparing different wikis and analyzing, okay, what's considered important enough to French speakers to be worthy of an entry, which may or may not get an entry in the German wiki, or, you know, which language has the longest Mozart entry versus the shortest, and so on. And it was one of these dedicated meta wiki fans who first noticed about a year ago that the number one most common topic, which had a Wikipedia entry in no fewer than 335 different languages, was a guy named David Woodard.
What?
Yeah.
I was going to go OJ.
Right.
But, yeah. What?
Yeah. And if you haven't heard of David Woodard, you're definitely not alone. And unfortunately, we do have to note that he is not a great guy. Woodard is a composer whose biggest claim to not fame is that he wrote a prequiem or pre-requiem in 2001 for Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh, who murdered 168 people and was at the time awaiting execution on death row. Woodard said the purpose of the piece was to, quote, cause the soul of Timothy McVeigh to go to heaven, and that, quote, McVeigh is 33 and nearly universally despised at the time of his execution, just like Jesus Christ.
Wow.
And there's a bunch of other stuff about him here, but the end result, not surprisingly, is that like Timothy McVeigh, Woodard is a big old white supremacist. That being said, he's not a famous white supremacist, so people were rightly confused as to why Woodard would have more wiki entries in more languages than such well-known topics as Japan or sex. And the obvious answer is he did it himself, right? It's just a case of a really dedicated and also evil self-promoter.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that theory is that Wikipedia actually has some pretty significant safeguards against people creating and editing their own entries. You can, you know, get away with it a little on a small scale, but Wikipedia does capture your IP address and keep a record of all the edits you make. And if you stick really intensely, even to a specific topic that isn't you, but maybe your personal soapbox, moderators will notice and you will get banned.
Hmm.
So how did he pull it off? Well, wiki editors are nothing if not thorough, and one particular user did a deep dive into all 335 entries to find out. Now, this investigator's username is GRNRCHST, which is obviously unpronounceable, so I'm just going to call him the Grinch. And the results of the Grinch's extensive investigation were published in the August 9th edition of The Signpost, which is an online newspaper hosted within Wikipedia covering Wikipedia-related news. And the Grinch did not mince words, concluding that Woodard's effort was, quote, the single largest self-promotion operation in Wikipedia's history, spanning over a decade and covering as many as 200 accounts and even more proxy IP addresses.
Sweet. Are you going to tell me how to do this?
Yeah. He noted that the effort seemed to begin in 2015, when a collection of new accounts began inserting Woodard's name into no fewer than 93 existing Wikipedia articles in English, including such seemingly unrelated entries as Pliers and Brown Pelican. By 2017, he started to branch out into foreign language versions of Wikipedia, creating new entries on the subject of himself in 92 different languages, writing an average of one new article every 6 days. This included articles in obscure languages spoken only by a relative handful of people in the world, like Nahuatl, Extremaduran, and Kirundi, as well as constructed languages that no one actually speaks, like Esperanto. Which, by the way, there's an Esperanto wiki, so have fun with that.
What is Esperanto? Sorry.
It's a made-up language that hippies in, like, the 60s and 70s were like, hey, instead of trying to let one language dominate, let's create a new language that's nobody's original language, and we'll all agree to learn to speak that. It didn't work. Nobody does it, but...
But it was constructed by linguists to be one of mm-hmm. the easiest languages to learn and speak, which would foster global adoption. Like, we learned nothing from the Tower
of Babel.
I have some Esperanto friends who are very committed to the bit online.
Really?
Yeah. There are some online communities like where you can go hang out and speak Esperanto.
Or Klingon, for that matter. Yeah. Whatever your fandom is. There's
some of my friends have also gotten into Tokipona, which is another conlang that's designed to be extremely simple, like even simpler than Esperanto.
Wow.
So don't underestimate the nerds that are on the periphery of society.
Mm-hmm. So with all this evidence in hand, once the expose was published, Wikipedia's global stewards immediately removed 235 articles on Woodard from rare language Wikipedia instances that don't have a lot of their own administrators. Larger wikis, however, were left to make their own community decisions, and 80 of them have since removed Woodard's articles as well, which, if you do the math, still leaves about 20 major language articles about the guy.
Mm-hmm.
And I do think it's safe to assume that those 20 articles are going to have a controversy stem added soon, but the Grinch himself is a believer in the rules, so as an interested party to the controversy, he's not going to add them himself. The important thing, he says, is that, quote, a full decade of dedicated self-promotion has been undone in only a few weeks by our community. And, you know, of course, the flip side of this is that Woodard is now getting quite a bit more publicity mm-hmm. than he ever did by putting an Esperanto entry about himself.
Mission accomplished.
I guess. I shun the man. I'm like... If it means he gets kicked out of restaurants now instead of being unknown, that's fine with me. All right, next link.
Next link.
All right, from SanFranciscoGate.com. Wild pigs found with blue meat in California are sparking alarm.
Okay, what did they consume? How dangerous is it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And this article starts with a wildlife trapper in Monterey County who made an unexpected discovery after capturing a series of wild pigs earlier in March. While processing the animals, the trapper found several with blue-tinged muscles and fat tissue. This discoloration is a result of exposure to diphasinone, an anticoagulant rodenticide that is often dyed to identify it as poison. So, yeah, poison. In an email to SF Gate, Fish and Wildlife Coordinator Ryan Berber said that the trapper observed the wild pigs eating directly from the rodent-side bait stations. So that's a good data point. The scope of the contamination, though, appears extensive across the southern part of Monterey County and along the Salinas River. Now, wild pigs are hybrid creatures. If you didn't know, they are part domesticated pig and part wild boar. They can weigh upwards of 200 pounds, and they now live in 56 out of 58 counties across the state of California, which is nearly all of them.
Probably Los Angeles, just because they can't live in there.
Yeah, honestly, that's probably the one place they're not, is the highly urbanized areas. Uh-huh. But they, I mean, we've talked about the feral hog problem. It's a problem in all the states.
Well, and remember, these wild pigs are part domesticated pigs. So you know that when George Clooney had that cute little pot-bellied pig that he outgrew...
Set it free.
Vince Bruzzone, owner of Full Boar Trapping and Wildlife Control. The pun is in there. It is. He is familiar with the oddity. This company was actually contracted by the Santa Clara Open Space Authority to help manage its wild pig population over the next 3 years. Contract valued at $243,000. He says he takes proactive measures because of this contamination issue. Quote, I do make a point to tell those I donate carcasses to that if they ever were to come across blue meat from one of my pigs, to dispose of it at a landfill rather than dumping it, and bring me the bill so that it doesn't enter the food chain. Which, for the owner of something called Full Boar Trapping and Wildlife Control, gotta respect that ecosystem awareness.
Yeah, well, you don't want to poison people. I mean, there's a liability concern.
That's right. That's your future income stream. You gotta preserve that somehow.
Yeah.
So, California banned diphasinone for most uses in January 2024, but ag exemptions due to their pest control needs kind of poked holes in that. For example, a statewide study in 2018 found rodenticide residues in 8.3% of wild pig tissue samples and an alarming 83% of bear samples. So after confirming the presence of this chemical, diphasinone, in the liver and stomach contents of wild pigs with blue tissues, Fish and Wildlife's Wildlife Health Laboratory is advising hunters to not consume meat from any animals showing discoloration.
Yeah, I imagine there'd have to be a lot of buildup of it for it to start to turn blue, but it's still going to be in there regardless of if it's blue yet.
Yeah.
It's in the blood.
Yeah. Got to be a better way.
There is. There's probably over 100,000 rat terriers in kennels right now that could be let loose and do the job, chemical free.
Yeah. We need to become like that city in Italy that has like millions of cats just wandering around. We need active animal predators back into our environments.
They're working on it. They're trying real hard. All right, next link.
Next link.
Got a short one here from Vice titled, Some People Just Don't Like Music. And now we might know why.
They lack
sociopaths.
Souls.
Sorry.
Their parents didn't love them.
We're biased here.
Wow. Realize that we have some anti-music discrimination in the population. No, it's funny. I did have a friend in high school who hated music. He would get actively upset if you tried to play it, if it came on the radio. I thought he was very funny for that.
I mean, Angie gets that way when you play the music of Fish.
Don't even.
Yeah, there's definitely certain types of music I get agitated by.
Oh, right. Fish the artist.
Yes, Fish the artist. P-H-I-S-H.
Because for a second, I was like, what do Fish listen
music.
To?
It's Fish music.
Little bubbles.
Yeah. It's not jam band music, I can tell you that.
So, a decade ago, researchers from the University of Barcelona decided to dig into the mystery of why some people feel nothing when the beat drops. These weren't curmudgeons who hate fun. They were folks who responded just fine to all the usual pleasures except for music, to which they would respond with a resounding meh. Co-author Joseph Marco Polaris explains that the condition isn't a hearing issue or a general brain dysfunction. Instead, it's a weak connection between two major brain systems, the auditory network and the reward circuit, which lights up when something feels good. When those systems don't talk to each other well, music can't spark joy. So to determine who might have this condition, researchers developed the Barcelona Music Reward Questionnaire. This five-pronged diagnostic tool examines how people interact with music emotionally, socially, physically, and habitually. People with musical anhedonia tend to score low across the board. And this could be just one example of a broader phenomenon. The theory of a neural misfire might explain why some people don't get pleasure from food, socializing, or even addictive substances.
I'm in the food camp, so I understand this completely.
Yeah, me too. I do not care about food at all. And I know people think I'm crazy for it, but it's...
It's just... What?
That's a really helpful framing, though, because instead of it being something that connects to pleasure, it's just more data or something that can promote overstimulation, right?
Yeah. Well, and so the question is, like, could you build that connection up? Like, is that something we could therapeutically generate? But also, I don't know that I want to. I kind of like not caring about food.
Keeps me from overeating when I'm stressed.
Yeah, but for, you know, making sure you don't get scurvy, this could have some potential benefit, right?
That's what them vitamins are for.
That's right.
So yeah, genetics, environment, or even specific brain injuries might veer the brain's wiring off course. So if you're the type for whom music leaves you feeling cold and emotionless, you can take heart in knowing that you're probably not broken. Your brain just isn't wired to find pleasure in it, whatever it is.
I mean, he said that at the beginning of the article that the brain was broken. There's not a connection between the two. So, I mean, it's fair. It's fair.
Yeah, what do we call it when there's too many connections between everything? I think that's schizophrenia. Yeah. I don't know what that is.
Yep. Next link.
Next link.
All right, it's pretty short, too. This is also from Discover. Finger amputations are surprisingly common. And toes may be the best replacement. Honestly, I picked this so that I could sing, I could feel it in my fingers, feel it in my toes. All right.
No.
Sorry to do that to everybody. Okay, so many people, a surprising high number of people lose their fingers, and especially if you lose a thumb, that's kind of ruins your hand. And while prosthetics and attempts to reattach the lost digit are typically the first solutions, toe transfer surgery, where the patient's toe is used to reconstruct the missing finger, offers a viable alternative that is gaining a foothold. Though not a new technique, toe transfers haven't widely been studied using validated measures for hand function for patient satisfaction. And this lack of data has meant that no formal guidelines exist to help clinicians decide when a toe might be a better option than the finger. To fill that gap, two doctors followed 75 patients who underwent 126 toe transfers at a plastic surgery unit in Glasgow. Their outcomes were compared with 96 replantation surgeries in 52 other patients, all assessed 5 or more years post-op. They looked at the key functions, so the ability to perform a tripod pinch, that's holding a pencil, and nerve sensitivity, and your range of motion. And across the board, toe transfer patients came out ahead. Surprisingly, foot function remained on par with the general population.
I mean, on par is also kind of a vague, like, as long as you're not constantly falling over. Some of us are clumsy, so like...
Right.
I mean, the thing is, full disclosure, I'm barefoot now, because I kind of always am, and I'm looking at my foot, and I have very short toes, I will admit, but I'm looking at it, I'm thinking the only realistic transfer you could do is my big toe for my thumb. Like, nothing else would even come close. It would be like half a joint's worth of a finger. It wouldn't, this has got to be for thumbs mostly, I'm assuming.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, it has to be more than that because they had 75 patients who underwent 126 toe transfers. So,
oh, it's just more than 75. Well, no, you could do both thumbs. You could get both thumbs involved.
At once, yeah. Next link.
Next link.
All right, here's a quick one from the BBC called Why Do Westerners Love to Use Toilet Paper?
Well,
so, yeah, you know, obligatory three seashells joke here. But the truth is, toilet paper is a very modern invention. And there's a decent chance, at least according to this article, that it won't be the norm in the future. So the first recorded use of paper for sanitary purposes was in China in the 6th century. But it wasn't until 1857 that manufactured toilet paper was first sold. And that was in America by a man named Joseph Gaietti. And this product in particular was actually more than just paper. It was kind of part of the great wellness revolution that was happening at that time with, you know, the patent medicines and Kellogg's cereal, which is a whole other story. But Gaietti's product was advertised as medicated paper for the water closet, also known as the greatest necessity of the age. And prior to that, humans had been using all kinds of stuff, some of which we've kind of talked about before here. The Japanese traditionally used a stick. The Romans used a dead sea sponge on a stick, which they note was a shared device in public toilets and very often spread disease. Other cultures throughout history used a washable cloth, corn husks, grass, animal skin, snow, and even rocks. And as you might expect, toilet paper, when it first came out, was expensive and only used by the upper classes, which made it a status symbol. Once it became ubiquitous, though, people had a hard time giving up the concept. So during the Cold War, when resources were scarce, most of the communist bloc countries used a state-manufactured roll made out of old newspapers. Or, if they were on the battlefield and didn't have access to newsprint, soldiers would commonly use whatever paper was around, including sensitive military documents that were no longer needed. And this led to the strange fact that one of the most fruitful Western spy operations of the era, known as Tamarisk, involved agents going through people's used toilet paper and trying to reconstruct those documents. But there were other places that rejected toilet paper altogether as disgusting and ineffective. In 1795, Narayan Singh, an official in India, expressed his disapproval of Western merchants by saying, quote, "What honor is left to us when we have to take orders from a handful of traders who have not yet learned to wash their bottoms?"
Fair point.
And still today in India, like most of the world, water remains the preferred way to clean your booty, often in a jug known as a lota. In the Middle East, the water comes from a handheld sprayer known as a shutuf. And of course, Japan is famous for its robotic bidets. And if you want to get sciencey about it, numerous studies have shown that water produces more sanitary results than toilet paper. Paper also has an impact on the environment, of course, accounting for 27,000 trees per day. It routinely clogs even plumbing systems that are designed for it, and most countries don't actually have that infrastructure and realistically couldn't afford to install it at any large scale. So it is pretty safe to assume that the cultural practice of toilet paper is at the very least not going to spread any further than it already has. And as we saw with COVID, it only took a slight disruption in the supply line to cause bidet sales to skyrocket in Western countries. So it is entirely possible that toilet paper will be phased out in our lifetimes. We're just going to have to wait and see.
Yeah, I see in far, far future, historians going, and they used trees to wipe their butt.
Right.
They did what?
Right, exactly.
Did what?
Yeah, we're sitting there going, a dead sea sponge on a stick. And it's like, is what you're using really better? All right, well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include the hardest working font in Manhattan, a murder in Silicon Valley, and ultra-processed foods might not be the real villain in our diets. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on DamnInteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/DamnInteristingWeek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Whisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.